the intense training that physicians go through to be individual contributors as a physician, great, great strength, often is exactly what is not required as a leader. So in other words, what got you there won't get you there as a leader. What got you there as a physician will not necessarily get you there as a leader.
Welcome to Medical Money Matters, the podcast where you can find experts, answers, and resources so that you can achieve mastery over the financial and business aspects of your practice. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Medical Money Matters. I am joined today by Deborah Dorsett, who is a national consultant and executive coach working with physicians and healthcare leaders around the country. She works with the Health Management Academy, and we are also fortunate to get to work with her in our Physician Leadership Project. And Deb, I just want to say thank you so much for joining me today. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
As have I. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll jump right in because there's a lot of great things to talk about. I know that you do a tremendous amount of development and leadership work with your clients. So I'm curious to hear from you. What makes for a successful leader from your perspective?
Yeah, well, there's many things that go into that mix and not necessarily the same amounts, but certainly caring about having a passion for what you're doing. Making, you know, a passion to make the organization better, to make the team better, to make healthcare better is important. The ability to work with and through others is probably the most important thing. So there's the vision, the purpose, the passion. There is also the working with and through others. And a lot of that is simply communication. And probably communication is the hardest thing to do. For the past, I'll say 40 years, organizational surveys have gone out about, you know, where organizations are rated according to their success of what they do well. And organizations that are exemplary, that are just wonderful in every measure, the feedback that comes back every year is, what could we do better? Communicate. And so being an effective communicator is probably one of the most difficult things a good leader must do, but one of the most important.
Absolutely.
That he or she must do.
Yeah. Well, and you've mentioned leading through others and accomplishing things by working through others, which is very different from how our physicians are trained. You know, being trained as a physician, that's an individual sport. And so this shift to, can I accomplish things with and through others, brings up a question of, you know, why would a physician who's been trained as an individual contributor want to move into leadership? What draws people?
Often it is a societal desire, part of our early socializations, that physicians are in a situation and thinking, I'm not the only one who's facing this problem. I'm not the only one who's having to deal with this. Surely there's a better way. If only we could get on the same page. If only we could ease the stress. If only we could be more efficient, more effective, then all of our lives would be easier. So one of the reasons leaders move into leadership is really the desire to make it easier, more efficient, more cost-effective, better outcomes, really to increase efficiency and effectiveness for the patient, for coworkers. And so they begin to try to think, what can I do to help for the greater good? That's not always the case, but often that is a pretty dominant reason that people move into leadership. Another is that sometimes physicians are so technically good I think of surgeons, I think of particularly orthopedic surgeons, but a lot of surgeons are just so excellent in their technical skills. They're like, well, you're really good. Mm-hmm. Others promote them. You can help us. You can help us be better. You can help us solve problems. So sometimes it comes from within, a desire of, I think I can make it better. I want to help make it better. Often, and many times it is someone else saying, I think you could help us. Please help us. So for both reasons.
Yeah, they're propelled by their peers. I mean, that's good peer pressure in a sense.
To have
that. And that begs a great question of, as people are feeling called, if you will, to step into a leadership role, what would you say are some of the most difficult things for physicians when they're wanting to move from that individual role into being a physician leader?
Exactly what you said. Because their training is so much of, I have the power, I can tell you to take your clothes off, I have the expertise, I have the ability to, you know, to diagnose and to write and to solve the problems and to figure things out. The intense training that physicians go through to be individual contributors as a physician, great, great strength, often is exactly what is not required as a leader. Yeah. So in other words, what got you there won't get you there as a leader. What got you there as a physician will not necessarily get you there as a leader. It really comes down, I think this is some reasons physicians are sometimes hesitant or wary of moving into leadership roles, mm-hmm. is because it does require a very different skill set. Yes. So suddenly you've got to be a team player. You've got to move from assessing, diagnosing, prescribing, solving the problem right now, expediting those solutions quickly, to planning for the future. And you don't get the immediate, I gave you the antibiotics and 2 weeks later, you're great.
Yeah.
You don't get that immediate feedback. Often in leadership roles, the feedback is quite delayed. It can be years before you know if anything you're doing, before you get any job satisfaction, before you get positive feedback, before you see the results. So it's a big focus between now and then the future orientation. You are no longer the expert. You don't have the answers. As a matter of fact, in leadership, if you go in and say, I'm the expert and I have the answers, you will likely disaffect most of the people on your team. You're like, no, thank you. I don't need you to be the boss of me.
Right.
So there's a whole different skill set that is required in terms of decision making, in terms of involving people, in terms of managing the inputs, managing the group dynamics, mm-hmm. managing the resources to get things done by due dates in a way that you keep your followers with you rather than disaffecting people. So I think there is a huge, just the realization, wow, there's a lot of skills I have to learn in order to be an effective leader is sometimes a lot. It's a lot. And sometimes it could be intimidating.
A bit, I imagine it would be a bit. There's a distinct shift. And you said something interesting about a moment ago about the shift for the physician from moving out of a space where they issue orders because they're in charge. You know, if you're in the OR, you're not really making requests. You're issuing orders, all in the service to taking care of the patient and having a successful surgery or a successful patient outcome. And then moving into leadership is not about issuing orders. It's really about making requests and, convincing, cajoling, whatever you need to do in order to, affect the change that you're wanting to affect as a leader. But very, very different skill set. And it really a different operating environment. As you said, different timelines as well. So,
and one way to think about that is, particularly in the example of an operating room, it's quite tangible. I mean, there's clear processes, there's clear desired outcomes, there are clear markers for this is not safe, this is safe, this is a boundary. So it's quite measurable, it's countable, it's observable, it's documentable, it's repeatable, mm-hmm. very tangible. Often the leadership is dealing with such intangibles. I mean, how do you deal with someone, my feelings were hurt, and they may never articulate that, or I don't trust you, or you didn't include me, or I don't like working with her. So there are a lot of things that are there. Often they're behaved out, but not labeled as such. We don't say at work overtly, I don't trust you, therefore I'm not going to cooperate with you.
Yeah.
We show it sometimes. Some people really get really good about not showing that, but leaders are dealing with those intangible, often unspoken things that are going on. And yet those are critical to their success and the success of their projects and the work they're doing.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. So one of the statements you made earlier in our conversation goes to this, and that was, you said 80% of organizational problems come from leadership. And that struck me. As a leader, I kind of went, ooh. But I agree. On reflection, I think you're spot on. I love it. Could you expand on that a little bit and how you see that play out?
Well, part of the goal of leadership is to see the whole. And yet, because there are levels and there are reporting relationships, often things in organizations work at cross purposes. So, and prevent people from being successful. So if you'll indulge me in a little bit of time, I'll tell you a case story of a new hospital, a beautiful, beautiful new hospital getting up and running and having problems with nurses, particularly. And at that time, the hospital had way too many travelers, which are mm-hmm. expensive. Yep. And the CEO told me, he said, there are five on a particular floor, we'll call it the fourth floor. There are five ringleaders on the fourth floor, nurses. And all they do is going around stirring up trouble. That's all they do. They're bad nurses, all of them on the whole floor. And I'm like, really? 60 bad nurses? That's interesting. So the question becomes, well, if these nurses are behaving badly, because their behavior is what was obvious of gossiping and inflaming and writing things, and then what's going on? The real issue. It was cheaper to hire me than it was to replace, because at that time, the replacement cost per nurse was $75,000 per nurse by the time we recruited them, onboarded them, got them up and functioning. So I was cheaper. So the quest becomes, what is going on with those nurses? Mm-hmm. And well, they hated their new nurse manager. Their new nurse manager was brand new to the hospital. It was a new hospital. She was also brand new to management. She was she was doing everything she could to keep the staff in place, enough nurses showing up to cover the patient's needs. So she stayed in her office and she sent out dictates. She sent out messages of what needed to be done. So there wasn't trust. There wasn't communication with the nurse manager. And moreover, neither she nor her second level of leaders in that floor had any idea about how to manage others. So there was a skill vacuum. There was a communication vacuum. That was a problem. And it turned out in talking with the nurses, there had been an implementation of a new system mm-hmm. of critical care nursing. So that means the nurses with the RNs were going to have a larger number of patients, but do the real critical stuff that they've been trained for. And there were to be assistants who would help patients with getting up and down and feeding and dressing and meals and so on. So that was what this system was based on, except there was a problem. And the problem was that when the CNO went to a meeting, O said, over budget, was going to have to give. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, she cut all of six assistants that were supposed to be on each shift. So now the nurses have more patients, no support, and so they're running really hard. And they were working 12-hour shifts. They would come in an hour early for handover. They would stay an hour late for handover, 14-hour days. They were not eating. They were not drinking water because they didn't have time to go to the restroom. So they were full out running. Wow. So they were exhausted and they never saw their nurse manager and they were unhappy. And I said, well, who implemented this new system? Well, we have an almost PhD who needs statistics to prove that her system works. So I ask her, you know, who approved this? I understand you want to collect your data to write your dissertation, but who approved this? The CNO did. Where is the CNO? No, she got moved out of the system because of some publicity surrounding her and a married surgeon. So she was gone. Yep. So that spot was vacant. The all but dissertation is carrying on as in her role, trying to guide the nurse managers who are trying to guide the people actually doing the work. And consequently, nobody is paying attention. So in reality, nobody knew how to solve the problem. So a consultant, me, was able to diagnose these nurses are, one, they're running, they're overworked. They have too many really seriously ill patients. They're overwhelmed. Nobody is listening. Nobody is supporting. People are doing dumb things that are not helpful. And no one is listening to them. They're simply saying, it's the way it is. It's the way it is. So clearly it's a leadership problem, but the ones being most effective are the frontline nurses. So long story short, we ultimately got an acting chief nursing officer who was able to redesignate that floor based on the severity of illness of the patient, the acuity of the patient, which reduced the number of patients per nurse. And he was able to hire some nursing assistants for them. But, and that relieved some of the pressure because in reality, what they were seeing, gossiping, explosive, bad attitude nurses were really very caring nurses who were scared they were going to kill a patient because of the system that wasn't working for them or for the patients. So when leaders create a system and implement a system and the system isn't working, they are the problem. So that's an example of how leaders create big problems.
That's a great example. And I love the part in there about the PhD actively working on her dissertation sort of feels a little bit like the tail wagging the dog, that somebody really paid to observe and is studying is actually making operational or influencing operational decisions and with little or no understanding of the impact of that. And that's the fun part. I expect you see this in your consultancy. We see it in ours when we go in, and I was trained early on, you know, you have to ask why five times before you really get way down. You know, in your example, you'd add about the fifth time you'd ask why, you'd hear, well, because there's a dissertation and there's a researcher and, you know, and there was a budget cut, but nobody put the two together and realized by removing the assistants out of the equation what that was doing to the nurses. And so the getting in and the asking of questions, I'm glad that that particular hospital had your expertise because I can only imagine. I was just listening, thinking, this is not a recipe for good quality patient care, you know, as we're going through and putting all these ingredients in here. Oh, my. And to your point, just the communication in general. One of our earlier podcasts, I talked about management by walking around. That's been one of my favorites over the years. And just that the formal and informal information you can glean by walking around and asking questions, you know, like where are all the assistants on this floor, you know, and why is the ratio so high, you know, or why do people feel stressed? So wonderful. Thank you for sharing that case study, and not uncommon, sadly, to see that in organizations. And frequently organizations can work when there's a little bit of a vacuum But when you have a lot of them, sort of in concert like that, it kind of creates the perfect storm. I'm glad you got to get in there and ask why a bunch of times. So we've talked a lot about communication being at the crux of a lot of the leadership. I think both the leadership wins and also the leadership challenges come down to a lot of communication. So what would you say are some of the most important facets of communication for a leader?
Probably if I had to come down to a number one thing to advise people to be more effective in communicating, leaders to be more effective, and I do. I do this ad nauseum. It sounds so easy, but it's hard to do. You know, if you think about a practicing physician, a physician can say, I need this report, I need this test, I need this done, I need. So speaking very directly about what they need in order to be able to treat a patient. As a leader, it doesn't really matter what you need. And this is a big switch on the mindset. What really matters is what do my followers need? What do the people that I support, that I represent, that I'm there to facilitate, what do they need? So when leaders can begin to appreciate and take on the other focus, as in, how may I help you? What may I do for you? What is important to you? How can I support you? The you focus becomes really powerful because at that moment, the leader is being selfless and giving to others in order to cooperate, in order to help and support. So interestingly, the leaders who are revered as wonderful leaders, great leaders, remembered leaders, are the ones that are there for his or her people. They operate from a you perspective rather than I need, a me perspective.
That's fantastic. I have frequently said to younger managers and leaders in their careers as they're looking for career guidance and development that, in my humble opinion, the leader or manager's job is to make everyone else's job as easy as possible. So it's like clear the barriers, find the resources, set the vision, help everybody figure out where we're going, and then get out of the way. And that a lot of your effort should be focused on what can you do to make their work as easy as possible. And I've often enjoyed that perspective in healthcare because it's very easy to see who's on the front line in healthcare. There's no question about that. And who's doing the hard work of patient care. And everyone who's not should be in support of the people who are. And that's, easier said than done sometimes. So a slightly different spin on that question. What makes for successful communication when you see leaders who are successful?
Well, successful leaders have the ability to take information in and digest it and understand what makes sense to them, but then also understand what makes sense to others. A commonality that we have as humans is we tend to think, I have common sense, and that's what common sense is. And that motivates me, therefore, that should motivate you. Parents often give great parental advice to their children about, well, this is what worked for me, therefore, you do the same thing and you'll be great, and they're not. So understanding that people have different motivations, are motivated for many different reasons. And so being able to look at a problem or a concern or an opportunity from all the different perspectives. So, a leader knowing yourself, knowing what works for you as you are processing a communication, something that needs to be taken care of, but then knowing resources that might look at it quite differently to challenge you to share information to add to your thinking. So, leaders learn to utilize people who are different from them, have different perspectives, different expertise, and add that to their thinking, tend to to make better decisions by being able to speak to everyone. So, you know, you might be concerned about dollars, somebody else might be concerned about patient safety, but whatever those issues are, you've thought about it from a variety of perspectives and vetted it with many different people before you lay it out as a here's where we're going or this is the plan.
Yeah. Well, that is a great segue to talk about one of the tools that you utilize in your consultancy. And that is the Personalysis tool. And I know, having been in those discussions where you lead the groups, that much of the output and the understanding that people get from the Personalysis tool is on communicating with others who take in information and process it differently than the way they do. So I'd love to hear from you a bit more about the tool and how you use it.
Well, first of all, I want to say I love most tools. I have used many, many tools over the years, and I found them all very helpful. But I will also admit that Personalysis for many years has been my favorite. And part of the reason why is it's a very, very clever tool. It captures, we're not always the same, depending on the day, the time of day, the energy level, what we're dealing with, the people we're with, we can behave in vastly different ways. So we're not always one way. And so Personalysis allows for the multidimensional behavior, potential for multidimensional behavior. So there's a range, and you know, we may use some of the behaviors or not. But we're not always cookie cutter. This is who you are and this is how you operate. So dealing with the complexities of individuals is really very helpful. I think Personalysis has a way of capturing our emotional core that I really am not familiar with other tools that do that. Mm-hmm. Our emotional core lives usually unconsciously. And so it kind of reveals our unconscious aspect of ourselves that we may not even know ourselves. Mm-hmm. We may not be even aware of ourselves. And yet that is so important in terms of our learning style, because we don't all learn the same way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Different ways of learning. In terms of, can I trust you? We have different yardsticks for measuring trust of, are you worthy of my trust or not? And you may have one measure, I may have a different one, and we may view each other as untrustworthy when simply our measures are different. Mm-hmm. So knowing, if I want Jill to trust me, how will I behave that will engender trust with her? Yeah. In terms of knowing what people's drives and motivations and ambitions are, everyone is motivated to do something. Unfortunately, leaders will say, but they're not motivated to do what I want them to do. Well, and that's true, yeah. But everyone is motivated to do something. So understanding really core motivations is important. Dealing with change, coping, dealing with stress, knowing how to self-replenish. There's a big topic now. Mm-hmm. The pandemic has brought the whole issue of physician burnout and nurse burnout and healthcare leader burnout, mm-hmm. but in particular, physician burnout to the forefront. As a matter of fact, I've worked with several people that is really their focus of what they're working on is physician burnout. And of course, the key to that is knowing how to self-nurture, mm-hmm. and being able to do it. And there are many things that are competing with you self-nurturing. There are always other things that you could do that sometimes are easier. I know I need to sleep. I know I need to exercise. I know I need to eat healthy. There are things we know, but it doesn't mean we do them. And it tends to be the more we're feeling stress, the less we do them. So it's really an interesting aspect of when you most need to self-nurture are the times when you're the least likely to self-nurture.
Yeah.
So being able to call oneself or having a support system that can call you and help you get back into normalcy for you of taking care of yourself is really important. And this tool gives insight about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say the insights are having experienced it with you really deep and a little bit startling sometimes, like how accurate it is. And then being in conversation with you, Deb, I always have the experience that you're talking specifically to me, even when you're addressing the whole group. It's
because it's always all about me.
Exactly. It's all about me. Well, and all of your points about, I like the notion of self-replenishment. I hadn't heard that phrase as sort of the antidote to burnout, but that's a phenomenal way to think about it. And I've seen in our sessions when you've come for the Physician Leadership Project, the breakthroughs and the insights that people can get about themselves. And I love the opportunity that the tool gives individuals for self-reflection and, you know, learning something about how you show up and how others perceive you. And we talk about executive presence, and that can be kind of a big topic and a little bit amorphous and a little hard to understand. So I've had several people say to me, yeah, executive presence is sort of one of those things that you know it when you see it. And but a skill that can be developed by physicians. And as we've said, it's a very, very different skill set, leaning into leadership. And a lot of the things that make them successful as physicians do not help and in many cases hinder as they're moving into leadership. So it's a fascinating space to work in. What are some of, could you share with us maybe one or two aha moments that you've seen your clients get in using Personalysis?
Well, it's not uncommon when I'm working, when I'm doing coaching with a leader using this tool, and I will describe their motivations, I will describe their expectations, I will describe roles that they really enjoy, activities they enjoy. And those are all three really different but important aspects of the individual. And then they have a team. They are in a position where they're leading a team. And they introduce me and they say, oh, let me tell you about the process I went through with Deborah. And she told me all about me. I thought she'd had a camera in my house. It was so profound. So that is a pretty common occurrence, that people are astounded by the level of information that is revealed about them. And as you're saying, people feel it's really personal and meaningful to them, that, you know, we all, as human beings, we all like a validation. Mm-hmm. And so in this sense, this tool is quite validating about who you are and why you are and what you do, why you do the things you do. So that is very validating. I just recently had the example as last week, as a matter of fact, of working with 45 regional leaders of a large healthcare system. And so there were all kinds of people in there, from finance to publicity to, of course, physicians and nurses. And we were talking about the need to process information. And almost all of us need alone, quiet time. And often that alone, quiet time is when we're doing mundane things, such as driving or walking the dog or washing the dishes or folding the laundry or rocking the baby or working in the garden. There's a lot of things that are quite just mundane activities, but allow processing time, which is really being with our emotional core and working to make sense of what's going on in my life and what do I need. And on a break, a psychiatrist came up to me and said, Deborah, you've really helped me understand something about myself. I lost my father 5 years ago, and almost immediately after his death, I began a huge clean out project. She said, I don't know why I did it. It wasn't a priority, but I just totally dove into cleaning out and organizing everything in terms of the house, of doing a clean out project. And she said, but now I realize that was giving me time to deal with my grief, to deal with my emotions of what was going on in losing my father. So it provided an activity, but it provided space where she did important emotional work for her, yes, of coming, dealing with her grief, coming to grips with the death of her father. And she needed to be alone, mm-hmm, to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that fascinating how we, unconsciously create space for the things that we need. And sometimes that comes out in a constructive way, and sometimes not so constructive.
Not so constructive.
But you can almost always look in retrospect, look at and point at, okay, there was, yeah, that was the underlying reason or the underlying need for something. That's phenomenal. And we all, I know I do this. We all like to think that our mental and behavioral health professionals have their lives all beautifully in order, and that nothing ever ruffles them. And so it's, but lovely that she got that objectivity of self about what was going on for her with using the tools. Well, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. I know that our audience will get a lot out of it as well. As I always like to do at the end of conversations is just to say, do you have any other pearls of wisdom that you would like to share with our audience?
Well, if anyone is contemplating, do I be a leader? Do I not be a leader? Is it worth it? Do I really want to learn all those icky things I have to learn? I would say you are the future, and we need you to step up. If you see problems, we need leaders to step up and be the solution. So I encourage all of your listeners to be brave and be forthright, right, and give it a go.
Wonderful. I'll second that motion. Thank you so much, Deb, as ever. Great to see you and spend time with you. Thanks.
You as well. Thank you so much.
You can find more information online at medicalmoneymatterspodcast.com, and you can subscribe to the Medical Money Matters content website for physician leaders to find budget templates and many other tools. We've included those links in the show notes. As I like to close out these podcasts, congratulations on taking the next step in your professional development and for making the commitment to learn about the financial and business aspects of your practice. I look forward to being on this journey with you and send you my heartfelt gratitude for all that you do for your patients all day, every day.